Menlo Park. He'd been thinking how pretty the city looked from the plane window, spread out like a tablecloth, as if you could just shake off the crumbs and fold the whole city away. It had been a picturesque thought, Ben pleased with his tablecloth analogy, until the plane hit a pocket of air. The ground careened up at the window, the two vodka sodas he'd drunk lurching in his stomach. A drop of pure, blinkered terror. Would he die staring at a seat-back television playing reruns of Frasier? They landed fine, in the end, his forehead only lightly pricked with sweat, a cocktail napkin shredded by his nervous hands. How quickly the possibility of annihilation was forgotten. The woman sitting next to Ben unbuckled her seatbelt, likely preparing to spring for the overhead bins the minute the seatbelt sign pinged off. Ben left his seatbelt on. No rush. No need to find the baggage carousel. Ben never packed more than a carry-on as a matter of pride. And anyway, this was only a 5-day trip. He'd gotten some work done on the flight, read over the newest draft from the ghostwriter. She seemed like a nice girl, not a bad writer, though the book was, of course, terrible. It was a memoir of Arthur's life, starting with his Kansas childhood, tracing the Stanford years, Menlo Park, the early days of the company, the explosion of outrageous fortune in the 80s. Arthur wanted to end the book with the board's takeover, a screed outlining his unfair ouster. Arthur felt he had been personally fucked by the universe, his downfall the result of prolonged and specific engineering by enemies, instead of the side effect of some light insider trading. Perhaps that's why Arthur had hired Ben to edit the book, some idea that they were both martyrs, victims, though Arthur was still a probable billionaire, and Ben was, most certainly not. Arthur wanted the book to have the structure of a hero's journey, a request he kept repeating in his many lengthy emails, emails that lacked punctuation, emails that piled up in the night, emails that grew increasingly hysterical in tone, even without the use of exclamation points. Had Ben read Castaneda? Arthur wanted to know. Had Ben read Robert McKee? Did Ben know about the Dark Night of the Soul? Ben buried the shredded napkin in the seat pocket, then settled back to turn his phone on. A bad feeling in his gut. Nothing new. Even so, it was better knowing they were 3 hours behind New York, like he'd slipped out of time. Eleanor was not answering texts anymore, even if Ben said it was serious, made it sound like suicide was definitely a possibility. His last text to her, please? She hadn't responded to him for months, since she heard they'd started the internal investigation. There was a new way everyone was killing themselves lately, all these celebrities hanging themselves from doorknobs. Ben had his own theory about the appeal of the method, mostly that it was low-key and mellow and basically less embarrassing than other methods. From the articles he'd read, you pretty much got to sit down the whole time. Much more manageable than flinging yourself off a building or a bridge. Less dramatic. He called a suicide hotline once, after Eleanor had moved out, but before his official dismissal. Ben had called mostly so he could later tell Eleanor he had. He'd immediately regretted it. The humiliation so great that he tried to hang up, but found he could not. Found himself robotically explaining the situation to a man who asked increasingly prurient questions about what exactly Ben had done and to whom. There was a text from Arthur's assistant confirming that a car would be waiting to pick him up. Black Suzuki Kizashi, license plate PPF 7780. And at least Stephen's guy had texted him back, sent an address. Ben looked it up. It wasn't too far out of the way, barely a detour. Surely the driver would be fine with a quick stop. He relaxed. The woman in the seat next to him sighed, her eyes fixed on the seatbelt sign. The instant the chime went off, she was up on her feet, pushing her way into the aisle, no matter the rows and rows that would have to drain before she could move forward. Things had not been great this last season. Enough months had passed that it might now, technically, count as more than a season. But it was comforting to imagine this mess cordoned off in a discrete unit of time, the benign kindergarten measurement of a season. Mostly he watched a tremendous amount of television, though he could no longer watch the show Eleanor produced, a show where celebrities discovered their genealogy. She always insisted, in her mild Midwestern accent, that it was dumb. But people seemed to enjoy it, delighted to watch an hour-long episode just to find out that Harry Connick Jr. was vaguely related to Buffalo Bill. He was smoking again, taking too many drugs, though strictly pharmaceutical, strictly in pill form. This distinction seemed somehow adult. He blamed Stephen, blonde, baby-faced Stephen, who showed up full of blistering tirades against the woman who'd replaced Ben, assurances that the office had fallen apart without him, ideas for projects they could start together, a podcast, a web series, a rich kid Stephen knew that he could hit up for funding, though Stephen was vague about when exactly the right time to approach this kid would be. "After the art fairs are over," he said, noncommittally. Ben had always been great at talking to rich people. That had been a basic requirement of his old job, being able to charm and flatter the wealthy people whose houses they featured in the magazine, people who looked to him to offer their lives some tint of depth or culture, who donated money or joined the board in order to cement this feeling, this connection to him. Rich people made you feel like everything was possible, because for them, everything actually was. Spending too much time in their world, you start to believe in life's inherent goodness, start to feel safe, exempt, certain of your own luck. Ben let himself get lulled by the pure proximity of money. He had believed, even after everything, that he might still be saved. But those people had disappeared too in the end, except for the board member who gave Ben's name to Arthur, suggested he might freelance edit his memoirs, a last act of mercy or pity. Ben was energized in these moments, brainstorming with Stephen, the ashtray filling steadily from Stephen's cigarettes. As soon as Stephen left, Ben felt worse. He shouldn't smoke, shouldn't hang out with kids in their 20s. A buzzing in his head, a tight skull. Certain refrains of songs looped, and he said them aloud and smiled. There was a night when he'd rushed to catch a train, late to meet a friend from the old days for a drink. The friend was ostensibly interviewing him for a job, but Ben knew it was a formality. Ben was, essentially, unhirable. Who knew for how long? Somebody must know these things, have some date in mind based on the relative severity of his misdeeds. But if so, no one was telling him. He'd been breathless, late, taking the subway stairs two at a time. Pushing through the turnstile, he saw, to his immense relief, that a train was already in the station. The doors were closed. Fuck! But suddenly they opened with a pressurized exhale. Perfect. But then Ben saw he was the only person on the platform, and there was no one inside the train. The dread came all at once. Ben decided to take the next train. There, easy. The problem had been solved. But the train didn't leave, idling in the station with its doors open. He understood, in some oblique way, that he could not get on the train, that the train was waiting for him specifically, that to get on the train would mean passing from this world and into another. This was a ludicrous thought. There were many reasons why the train might be delayed. but it seemed to be there a long time, idling, and every moment that passed increased his panic. The train would not leave until he was inside. He was sure of it. The orange seats were lit brightly, and he saw the back of the conductor's head and shoulders, but could not see his face. And somehow, this was the most frightening thing of all.
"Flag good, all that?"
the driver said.
"Yeah,"
Ben said. "Thanks." He kept his bag with him in the back seat.
"We're lucky,"
the driver said, pulling into the lane that sluiced cars out of the airport.
"Traffic shouldn't be so bad this time of day, going south."
"Actually," Ben said, leaning forward,
"do you mind if we stop somewhere else first? I checked and it's not really out of the way. It'll take a second."
The driver shrugged. He would not have a problem with a detour. Or if he did, he wouldn't say so. He handed back his phone, nested in a giant phone case printed in camouflage.
"Plug in the address?"
The directions took them to a neighborhood out toward the ocean, beige apartments with Spanish doorways, wooden decks that looked softened from sea air. The streets were wide compared to New York, though there were fewer people on the sidewalks, just students waiting for the train. They wore jackets and beanies, shivering in the fog. Two girls were zipped into one sweatshirt, hobbling like a strange beast on the platform, laughing.
"Should I park?"
the driver said, pulling up to a stucco building.
"Nah, I'll only be a minute. Seriously."
The guy who opened the apartment door seemed sleepy, trying to act businesslike, though he was barefoot, his eyes at half-mast. He made a point of glancing behind Ben into the empty hallway.
"I thought you'd be a little later,"
the man said, pushing his feet into a pair of sandals by the door.
"Come on in."
Inside the apartment, a girl sat on the couch, wearing a vintage dress cinched at the waist.
"This is Steven's friend," the guy announced.
"Hi,"
the girl said, tucking her feet under the bell of her dress. Her hair was burgundy, a hair color Ben associated with 1993.
"And how do you know Steven?"
the man said, taking out a tackle box. He gestured for Ben to join him at the kitchen table.
"He's my assistant," Ben said.
Or former assistant, but who cared at this point? "He gave me your number."
"Nice guy, Steven."
"Great guy." This was the kind of non-talk meant to make them feel like this was a normal transaction, like any other.
"Yeah, I should visit Steven out there sometime,"
the guy said.
"You hate New York,"
the girl said from the couch.
"You said it was..."
Here she paused for a moment, blinking.
"Terrible."
She glanced over at the table and shot Ben a disarming smile.
Did she know about him? He wondered suddenly. Had she heard everything he'd allegedly done? He was being stupid. Of course she hadn't.
When he left, the girl yawned on the couch, waved. The exchange was over. Money had passed hands. Success. Like a game, obstacles dodged and the reward reached, the chime of good things happening. Ben tried to swallow a pill in the stairwell, but he had to stop to cough, bracing himself against the wall. He tried to cough quietly, but the effort only made him cough harder until the pill finally broke apart in his throat.
"All good?"
the driver said, jerking to attention when Ben opened the door.
"A friend from New York,"
Ben said.
"I just had to drop something off." "New York's great,"
the driver said.
"I've been, probably 5 times.
"Yeah," Ben said.
"It's great."
He sat back in the seat, the car warm from the heater. He, too, had once thought New York was great. A great city. Ben's brother had visited him there. Only that one time. Poor Jude. Now living in an SRO in Long Beach, certain that his whole life was a television show, that he was being watched. His mother had once used a metal detector, waving it around Jude's head, trying to convince him it was a device that would turn off the voices. Weirdly, it had worked.
briefly anyway. Jude had visited him in New York before all that started, though probably there were clues. Even if there had been, Ben had been too consumed by his own life to notice anything amiss with his brother's. It was the year Ben had gotten promoted, a time when he was profiled by interviewers who ordered whole bottles of wine at expensed lunches. Interviewers who called his old professors to hear specifics of his smarts, a time when he got emails of congratulations from people he had once idolized and had to mete out his attention at parties like it was a tangible resource, which he supposed it had actually been. He had not yet proposed to Eleanor, but they both knew it would happen soon. It was a time of great fortune, Ben would think after. Though that wasn't anything they said at the time, not aloud, or even thought to themselves. There was no reason to believe it might be temporary. Ben didn't like to remember Jude's single visit, the silence that curdled between them, how Ben kept Eleanor away from Jude on purpose. "Maybe we could go to a club," Jude had suggested one night, wearing a shirt that was brand new and buttoned tightly at the wrists and neck. It was Jude's first time on the East Coast. His brother, who had always been older, who had always known more, who'd punched Ben in the stomach in front of his friends when he was 12 and tried to show him how to use a camcorder. Ben had not taken Jude to a club. Ben had not taken Jude to the Empire State Building. The ways he had been unkind, he didn't have a hard time remembering. The car left the city. The hills were green, the fog dropping down through the canyons. The ground, when it was visible through all the green, was bright ochre.
"So, here on vacation?" the driver said.
"Just for work," Ben said, trying to forestall more conversation, though the driver didn't seem to track this effort.
"What kind of work?" he said.
"A book," Ben said. "Working on a book."
"Wow, you wrote a book?"
The driver looked admiringly in the rear view. How easily Ben was annoyed, his hackles up.
"I'm only editing it. Someone else wrote it." "So someone else does the writing?"
Ben couldn't see the driver's face, but he could imagine it.
"And you just help after?" "Cushy," the driver said.
He deserved the man's contempt. The driver didn't understand that Ben already felt bad. Already felt cosmically punished. He wasn't supposed to think of these things, to go down tangents of imagining the situation turning out some other way. Maybe it was that Ben had been watching so much television lately. But reversals of fortune seemed somehow possible. The world infinitely malleable, people competing to bake cakes in the shape of flowers and dogs, winning thousands of dollars for it. The blood of Harry Connick Jr. and Buffalo Bill pumping the same strains of DNA. The miracle of nighttime falling in New York when here it was still light. The landscape that churned past was so lovely that, for a moment, Ben forgot the good feeling was synthetic. The pill had started to work, a catch in his throat like pleasure at an unexpected gift, a sudden, surprised expansiveness. So he felt a surge of affection for the driver, so accommodating of his detour, affection for Arthur, who'd paid for Ben to be here, paid for this car to pick him up. Arthur, who believed Ben still had value. What had it said in the latest draft of Arthur's book? "Whatever you dream, you can achieve. Whatever you dream." It was so old-fashioned, so Norman Vincent Peale. But Arthur was, what, nearing 60? Ben's head was against the car window now, and he felt the car turning. When had they gotten off the freeway? The land was green and damp and mossy, like a Tolkien valley, one of the books his mother had read to him and Jude when they were boys. She had lit a candle when she read to them at night. A parenting tick that now seemed very peculiar. When he looked up, the driver was staring at him. The car was stopped.
"Brother?" The driver cleared his throat. "You all set?"
Ben sensed they had been stopped for a while.
He tried to give the driver money for a tip, but he wouldn't take it.
"It's included," the driver said, waving him away. Perhaps the look on the man's face was embarrassment.
The new thing, Arthur told Ben, was toad venom. Much better than ayahuasca, since it didn't last so long. And truly, he was a little scared of it because it was fucking intense. But that was the exact reason to do it. Didn't Ben agree?
Did Ben know if you legally formed a religious group, you could avoid taxes and import certain ceremonial drugs without issue? Did Ben know that the U.S. had the power to turn off the internet in another country?
A whole country, Arthur said, hooting. Flip a switch and just total blackout. They should do it here. Save us all from ourselves. But of course they won't.
Arthur was in a polo shirt and sweatpants. He had a rubbery face, like a sitcom star dialed up too many notches, and drank water at regular intervals from a metal water bottle clutched in his big paws. He showed Ben a photo of himself with the Pope, which seemed like a joke, in the same way it seemed like a joke when Arthur wrote Ben's name at the top of a blank piece of paper and underlined it twice. They sat in the living room of an old Victorian house on the property that Arthur had, for some reason, turned into a recording studio. "Do you play music?" Ben said. Arthur looked blandly at the microphones.
"No," he said. "Maybe someday."
Arthur wanted to start off by going through the first chapter, page by page, essentially word by word. Surely Arthur must have somewhere else to be, his hours worth some unimaginable amount. But he seemed unhurried, ready to hunker down for the afternoon. He made Ben read each sentence aloud, Arthur's eyes closed, face straining to absorb each word.
"Okay," Arthur said, solemnly. "Very good."
Ben had never worked in this painstaking manner with anyone, but it was kind of nice, the way he had imagined books got edited when he was in high school. Certain things irked Arthur without reason. He wanted to use English spellings, didn't like Ben changing girl to woman. Arthur stopped Ben in the middle of a sentence, got to his feet, then reached his arms toward the ceiling before slumping over, bent at the waist, swaying a little side to side.
"First you nod your head yes, then you shake your head no," Arthur said, moving accordingly. "It's a good way to release the neck."
When Arthur righted himself, he was breathing hard, his face red. Halfway through the first session, a man wandered in and sat down with Arthur and Ben. Arthur didn't introduce him. When the man looked at Ben, it was with the barest attention. He had rimless glasses and wore a Patagonia jacket, a jacket he didn't remove. He listened idly to Ben and Arthur discussing the chapter on Arthur dropping out of Stanford, making a show of his boredom.
"Can we get a little something?" the man said. "A little snack? I don't know."
Arthur sent a message on his phone, and a different assistant arrived than the woman who had opened the gate for Ben. This girl was younger, European-seeming.
"Let's get Dave and Ben some knish," Arthur said. "That kind we had the other day?"
The girl laughed a little uncertainly. "Knish," she repeated. She had an accent.
"Knish,"
Dave repeated, imitating her, his pronunciation clumsy. The girl fell into a fit of giggles.
"Knish," she said. "Knish."
Arthur let his hand float at her hip for a brief second.
"Exactly."
Ben wasn't imagining it. Arthur's main assistant, Karen, was brusque with him, and he didn't know if it was because she had read the articles or tweets or whatever and was trying to forestall some imagined misdeed or if this was just her personality. She was responsible for ferrying him to and from the guest house where he was staying on the far corner of the property. Normally, Ben would have been able to walk the distance from there to the Victorian where they were editing, but rains had washed out the road and she had to drive him the back way.
her car sleek and spotless. He didn't care about cars, but he knew it was an expensive one. Karen was probably Ben's age, wore black leggings and running jackets, and had, actually, a nice body. He gathered she lived either on the property or very close by, and that she had worked for Arthur for at least a decade. "How'd it go today?" she asked, and he said, "Great," before she had finished the question. A silence fell. Ben was about to ask her whether she was from the area, but already Karen was back to talking about Arthur, the book project. They had created some self-publishing arm of Arthur's new business, hatched some plan to get this book into the hands of the young people, but Ben hadn't followed the relentless emails closely enough to weigh in. "Just keep in mind we are wanting to get this book out by summer," Karen said. "He wants to distribute it at the music festivals, you know, though honestly, we think we can finish it sooner. If you think that's possible?" When Ben didn't say anything, she looked at him. "Oh, yeah, for sure," he said. "That's totally possible." She seemed pleased. And it was true. All sorts of things seemed possible here. Whatever you dream, you can achieve. That was, as Arthur was always saying, the main theme of his book. Ben said this line aloud to Karen, waiting for her mask to falter, for her to make some acknowledgement that she worked for a full lunatic. But her eyes just darted to his, her expression landing somewhere between confusion and boredom. She pulled up in front of the guest house, leaving the car running. "Well, thanks," he said, "for the ride." Why did he linger in the car? Out of habit? Or maybe boredom? He tried to hold Karen's gaze longer than necessary, smiling the old, confident smile. A little game, harmless, seeing if she would play ball. He had been considered a charming man. Hadn't people said that? He cocked his head a little, his smile clicking into a lower gear. And Karen smiled back. Finally, her face going soft. She seemed then to get flustered, pushing her hair behind her ears, clearing her throat. "Just text if you need anything," she said. "I'll let you know what time Arthur wants to start in the morning." The guest house was lonely. There was nothing on the walls except for a few black and white photos of peeling eucalyptus trees and a framed poster from a Big Brother and the Holding Company show at the Palace of Fine Arts. The windows looked out on greenness, the oaks, the neon hills, the steep edge of a canyon. There was an espresso machine, and the refrigerator was empty except for a canister of coffee beans and a box of baking soda. The internet was shockingly fast, the cell reception impeccable. Ben wished it wasn't, so he could imagine Eleanor had called him back and he had just missed it. Arthur wanted his book to have a standalone chapter on human potential. Arthur wanted an appendix of his favorite quotations by great thinkers. Arthur wanted his morning routine reproduced on the flaps of the book jacket. Arthur's phone background was a list of his monthly goals. He skipped breakfast and ate only a green vegetable slurry for lunch, so he could eat sickening amounts of food for dinner. Arthur did not drink alcohol. Arthur believed yogurt cured heartburn. When Ben bored him, his eyes pinballed in search of other information, though he would leave a smile on his face, inert. When he was thinking, he stood up and bounced from foot to foot. If Ben went to the bathroom, usually to take a pill with a slug of warm water scooped with his hand directly from the faucet, he returned to find Arthur in child's pose on the carpet. "Then we transition into corpse pose," Arthur said, sprawling on his back, eyes closed. "One general life trick," Arthur told Ben in a conspiratorial tone, "was to listen to audiobooks at 1.5 speed, so you got through them faster." Arthur was concerned, he told Ben, that the ghostwriter's chapters were slack. "In terms of momentum," Arthur said, stabbing at a page, "forward motion, don't you think? Have you read Stephen King's book on writing?" Ben agreed. "Yes, definitely. The pages were reading a little limp." Arthur relaxed, drank a glug of water. Maybe you should rewrite all this, Arthur said, waving his hand over the pile of pages. Hmm? What do you think of that?
Ben demurred.
I'm just here to edit, he said, though Ben had always privately believed he would be a good writer. Maybe great.
When they fell into what Arthur announced was an energetic rut, Arthur took Ben for a drive in his car along the back roads, deep in the redwoods. His car was immaculate, the air tight with the off-gassings of the leather seats. Arthur turned on the stereo, blasting a song from 50 years ago, the sound system perfectly calibrated to soak them both in the audio.
You like this guy?
Arthur said, almost shouting, gesturing at the speakers. Ben nodded.
Sure. He lived around here in the 60s, wrote this very song while he was living on his ranch, basically next door to my spot, Arthur said. Did he know that?
Ben shook his head.
Can you believe it? A 20-year-old kid writing a song like this?
Arthur turned the music up.
He crashed right around here. Blammo! Right into a redwood. You want to go see? See where the great man died? Let's see. I marked the coordinates. Exact coordinates. It should be saved.
Arthur messed with the screen on the car's dashboard, a GPS map shifting and reloading, changing perspectives, the red arrow coursing along the on-screen streets like a video game avatar. Occasionally a woman's voice would cut through the music, telling Arthur to take a left in 400 feet or stay right at the next fork. The volume level on the speakers was turned up so high that they seemed to be inside the woman's mouth. They looked, according to the map, to have almost reached the destination when Arthur missed a turn. The GPS instructions had been very clear, but he'd still sailed past, causing the GPS to beep an alarm. Arthur was suddenly panicked, eyes jerking between the screen and the road. The car lurched, then accelerated.
You let me miss the turn,
Arthur shouted at Ben with genuine anger.
In a way, it felt nice to have someone be mad to his face.
Before Ben could respond, the woman's voice filled the car, crisp, relentless, calculating, calculating.
3 days here, and they'd only edited up to the fourth chapter.
Ben printed out the fifth chapter and reread it at the kitchen table of the guest house, drinking a glass of warm white wine from the case he'd found in the pantry. According to the label, the wine was biodynamic. It was the color of marmalade, full of sediment that coated his teeth.
Was it just the wine mixed with half a pill, or was this fifth chapter genuinely moving?
He took a drink, flipped the page. Arthur had never been on an airplane until flying to Stanford from Kansas at age 17. It was touching to imagine young Arthur exiting the plane, the warm California wind greeting him off the tarmac. Sweet. He had started, actually, to like Arthur. Maybe, since they were so far behind, Arthur would ask Ben to stay on longer. Or maybe, when this project was over, Arthur would hire him full-time. Maybe there was some kind of position available. Or maybe Ben would actually rewrite the book, then use the money he made to write his own. It was nice in the guest house, deep in the blue shadows of all these redwoods. You can make a life up here, only descending the mountain once in a while for necessities. He opened a new email before he could think too much about it.
How to phrase it in a way that Arthur would find convincing. Maybe make a point of how similar they were, he and Arthur. Men who persevered. Add a dash of that muddy beat mysticism Arthur was so horny for. As you taught me, what you dream, you can achieve. And I truly believe that I am the best person to write this book. Jack Kerouac said, the only people for me are the mad ones. Mad to live, mad to die, people who burn, burn, burn like Roman candles. He'd look up the exact quote before he sent it. When I met you, I recognized you instantly as one of these mad ones, a secret sharer. And that's only one of the reasons I feel I have a mandate to tell your story.
Before he realized it, the email was 4 paragraphs long. It was the longest piece of writing he'd done in months. He copied and pasted the right quote. He hadn't remembered that last part, the line about the Roman candles exploding like spiders, and skimmed the email twice.
Good, he thought. Pretty good.
He pressed send. He brushed his teeth, barely, and was taking out his contacts in the bright marble bathroom, his mind wandering, when he suddenly realized he'd lost one of his contacts, that it must have slipped behind his eyeball. He swiped his fingers at his eye. Nothing. There in the contact case on the counter was one single contact, a ghostly circle floating in the solution. One contact already in the case, the other, where? Slipping around his skull? His heart was beating fast. Hadn't he once read a news story where this had happened to someone? Hadn't the woman eventually gone blind? He pulled out his right eyelid, pushing his face close to the mirror, blinking hard. Already his eye was tearing up, and when he tried again to grasp for the lens, it stung. Had he scratched himself somehow? He sat on the cold floor. He was crying, but only from the right eye. He touched the wetness, convinced it would be blood. Karen sounded suspicious on the phone, like this was some ruse he'd devised to get her to the guest house late at night. But when he answered the door, weeping from one eye, Karen seemed to soften. She led him to a chair in the kitchen under the bright overhead light, where he sat with his head tilted back. He felt very young suddenly, his throat exposed, wearing a t-shirt, his feet bare. He was vaguely aware that the kitchen was dirty, that there was an empty bottle of wine in the sink and another bottle, half full, uncorked and left out on the counter. She was nearer to his face, holding open his eyelid with 2 fingers. He could smell her breath. Gamey, savory. She must have just eaten dinner. He wondered, idly, if she had a partner, or if she'd eaten alone. Her hair was down her shoulders, a little wet from a shower.
I don't see anything, Karen said. Now, I'm just going to use the flashlight on my phone, she said, talking very slowly. I'm sure we'll get it.
His left eye was closed tightly, Karen almost straddling him. His right eye shuddered in the wash of the flashlight, his eyeball rolling around.
I don't want to hurt you, she said.
You don't see it? Can you feel it?
He felt her finger almost touch his eyeball, then spring back.
Sorry, I can't do this, she said. I'm just worried I'm going to scratch you.
Ben sat with both his eyes closed, his right eye feeling swollen, enlarged in its socket.
It was better to keep both eyes shut, to know Karen was here at the table.
Is there a hospital or something?
He said, his eyes still closed.
I just don't want it to get bad.
Maybe you'll just blink it out during the night? Like, it'll come out while you sleep?
Maybe.
When he opened just his left eye, he saw Karen was sitting too close, her chin resting on a propped elbow.
Hi,
she said, smiling in a queer way. It took him a moment before he realized the energy in the room was familiar from what he thought of as the old days, when women seemed to hold his gaze meaningfully and punctuate their anecdotes with little touches of his arm. And that's what he was shocked no one had ever talked about. How many of the women had pursued him, called him? Even Eleanor had gotten his email from a friend and written him with a question about a movie he had introduced at a screening the week prior.
Does it hurt very badly?
Karen said, making a gesture like she was about to touch his face. Ben was on edge now, not only because of the lens he was sure was hardening into shards that might puncture his optical nerve, but this sense of Karen leaning closer. He had forgotten what came next. He was meant to lean in too, to keep her gaze,
but his eye hurt too badly, and he worried suddenly that Eleanor would find out Karen was here, here in his house. Of course it didn't matter. Of course Eleanor no longer cared. She was supposedly staying with her mother in Key West. Why? She was scared of the ocean. On their honeymoon, she hadn't left the towel, had gotten sunburned reading through the diaries of John Cheever, a sunburn so bad she couldn't sleep or stand to be touched. Ben got to his feet.
I'm sure it's fine, he said. Really. But if you're in pain...
Karen stood up. Through his squinted eye, he saw that she was not wearing a bra. She was very attractive, he thought. But the thought just hovered, inert, unattached to anything. Is this what they had wanted? What everyone had wanted? For him to have these neutered, benign thoughts about women? Thoughts that did not immediately translate into action? It wasn't the worst thing.
Sorry, Ben said, to have bothered you.
I should let you get some sleep, Karen said. She went to the sink, made a show of rinsing the empty bottle, putting it in the recycling.
He could just wrap this night up. Both of them could go to bed.
But he didn't move.
Karen could speak to Arthur for him. That wasn't a bad idea, was it? Karen talking up Ben? Telling Arthur Ben should take over the writing of the book? He would never have to go back to New York. Do you want a glass of wine or something?
He said, clearing his throat.
I feel bad making you come over for this.
She considered, for a moment, a question in her face that he couldn't quite parse. Why not? She poured herself a glass of the open wine and refilled his glass. She put the bottle in the fridge. He sat down so he could keep both of his eyes closed, concentrate on the task at hand.
I've really liked working with Arthur, he began.
He's actually a really good boss. Karen's voice floated through the buzzy darkness. Arthur.
I know he's not that happy with the book. Right now, I mean, this last draft.
He could hear that Karen had sat down, too.
I'm not sleeping with him, she said. And laughed. I mean, just so you know, if that's what you're worried about.
She had misinterpreted something in his tone.
Had he lost it? The ability to control a conversation? Stand back and watch it take its intended shape? Of course not, he said. The idea had honestly not occurred to him. You're too good for Arthur.
He smiled the old smile. When he opened one eye to gauge the smile's effect, Karen was close.
You're sweet, Karen said, laughing again.
Which of them leaned forward first?
Ben used to be so in control in situations like this that time would slow down to an almost comically chewy speed. Every centimeter of movement observed, every breath noted. Like how the spy in those movies had been able to take in every detail of the crowded train station, the ticking clock, the woman pushing the baby carriage, the train arriving on track 4, the train leaving on track 5, digesting all the variables, calculating the correct path of action in the split second before he shot the villain in the head. But something had happened. Ben was disoriented. No longer had the ability to locate himself, much less anyone else. Everything was murky, his own thoughts dim, Karen's thoughts unimaginable. They were kissing. He was kissing her back. Or maybe she was kissing him back. It was dizzying how little he knew. He pulled away. Sorry.
Karen looked stricken.
He should have waited to bring up Arthur some other time, bring up the job, because when he did, blurting it out in the silence after he apologized, her face darkened.
It took a second for him to read her expression. She was angry.
It startled him how angry she looked.
His hand reflexively went up to cover his right eye, maybe to remind her that he was actually hurt,
that she should feel sorry for him, but she rolled her own eyes and stood up. She stared at him, filled with, what? Hatred? Pity? Really? She said. He could tell she wanted some response from him, needed it, but he couldn't muster anything. Sadness hovered in the room. Arthur wouldn't have a job for him. Eleanor wasn't coming home. Karen banged the door shut, flouncing out into the darkness. Ben's eye ached, but it wasn't unbearable. He felt his heartbeat in his eye socket. Chapter 5 was stacked on the table. At least Arthur got to tell his story. Or have a ghostwriter tell his story. Put it all in one place, link it together. So whatever had happened in his life seemed to beget the next thing that happened, step after step, in one long and glorious ascension. It wasn't fair. Eleanor had never even let Ben try to explain himself, while Arthur got 90,000 words to lay it all out. Arthur's many failures, the SEC fines, stepping down from his own company, the agreement that Arthur would never hold an executive position in any business again. Somehow the book had taken this raw evidence and massaged it into the shape of something even better, a tale of success and perseverance. The ghostwriter was, actually, fucking great at her job. It occurred to Ben, looking at the stack of chapter pages, that he could see the pages clearly, could see everything from his left eye clearly, which meant he must have a contact lens in after all. The lens he'd seen in the contact case was from his right eye. The other was in his left. Nothing was lost. All had been accounted for. He laughed, giddy with his own stupidity. An hour clawing at an empty eye. All this useless terror. Ben had the impulse to text Karen, tell her everything was fine, that it had just been a false alarm. It was funny, wasn't it? A funny story? How scared he'd been over nothing? So certain he was in danger. But he didn't text her. And when he did hear from Karen, it was a text, curt, arriving at 7 a.m. the next morning, informing him that Arthur no longer required his services, though Ben would be paid the outstanding amount of his fee. A driver would be at the guest house in an hour to take Ben to the airport, to take him back the way he'd come. Ben was about to formulate a response, his throat already starting to close, his forehead sweating, when three dots appeared on screen, Karen still texting. Saying what? Explaining? Was someone, finally, about to apologize to him? He waited. Then her text arrived. Black BMW X3, license plate FMX 2217.